We'll call the House Committee on Taxes to order. We do not have a quorum yet. We'll officially call the meeting to order as soon as we do. We will take care of some business at that point. What I'd like to do right now is get right into reviewing the governor's budget proposal. We're very fortunate today to have Assistant Commissioner Matt Mossman with us today to make a presentation on the governor's budget proposal. And what I would like to do is let Mr. Mossman get completely through his presentation, and if that takes an hour, 2 hours, 6 days, whatever it takes, you'll have that time, Assistant Commissioner. And then at that point, what my plan would be to have questions from members of Mr. Mossman. And then after that point, we will have proponents of the budget proposal. We'll have as much time as they need to testify. And when I say as much time, that might be within limits. I mean, we can only go till midnight every night. And then after that, we will have people that have concerns with the budget proposal. We'll have time to testify. And then at some point here, there'll be bills introduced. I don't know who is going to be carrying the budget proposals. We will work on that, find that out. And then we will be taking votes on the tax portions of the governor's proposal. So, Mr. Mossman, welcome to the Tax Committee. And the only time you should be interrupted today would be when we have a quorum, and I'll be officially calling the meeting to order and conducting a few items of business. Otherwise, if you could please state your name for the record and who you represent, and then please provide your overview. We have a quorum. We'll officially call the meeting of the Tax Committee to order on February 16, 2011. Representative Marquardt will move the minutes of February 15. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are passed. Mr. Mossman, you have the floor, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. Good morning. Just to get started,
Mr. Mossman, if you could please introduce yourself. And
sure. My apologies. Yes, Matt Mossman, Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy with the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair and members, what I plan to do is to just, I think you all have the tax policy budget book that was released yesterday, and in general, I'll just be following that in order, walking through those provisions. Just a few quick comments in getting started, as I think there are themes that you'll see in the language of the budget pages throughout. The governor and the direction he gave in terms of looking for budget proposals for us was very clear about a couple things that were really high priorities for him, obviously needing to balance the budget in a way that he felt was fair and that was structurally balanced, provided a permanent solution to the ongoing budget problems, and I think you'll see that throughout the recommendations, as well as he's really followed closely the tax incidence study and the findings of that study in terms of the total share of income paid for state and local taxes at various income levels and how that tails off at the high end, and shaping his recommendations around that understanding and those findings. And so I think you'll kind of see those concepts throughout his recommendations here today that I'm going to walk through. Starting on page 4 is where I'm going to start, Mr. Chairman, just to kind of give, page 5, to give an overview of the recommendations from kind of a spreadsheet perspective. The overall recommendation, the total for the recommendations in the tax policy area is $3.3 billion down in the lower right-hand column there for fiscal 12 and 13. And all of the recommendations in the tax policy area, there are some background pages on local aids and credits, but the recommendations here, all of the page recommendations, relate to the tax tax provisions in state law. The governor has no recommendations for changes in any local government aid programs or property tax refund or relief programs. So there are no recommendations here at all, so we'll be just discussing the revenue related provisions. So $3.3 billion, highlighting from the top of the page, Mr. Chairman and members, the largest of the recommendations in that mix is our recommendations for a new fourth tier income tax that would generate $1.89 billion over the 2 years, as well as a temporary surtax on incomes over $500,000 that would generate $918 million a year, and total $2.8 billion from the income tax when you factor in the part-year resident provision and some other provisions there. The corporate franchise tax in general for the four provisions, there's more than four provisions. For the provisions in that area, the largest provision, and we'll get to the budget pages, is the recommended repeal of the foreign royalty subtraction and FOC preferences. That would generate $272 million in additional revenue, and there's overall $355 million of recommendations in that tax area. A smaller amount, there are recommendations in the sales and use tax area, all really of which revolve around attempting to make some adjustments, modernizations, and the definitions of some statutory provisions around the sales tax that the governor sees as tax fairness issues for items that are really already taxable under current law, and making sure that some of those items are taxable depending, you know, regardless of how people purchase them. Federal conformity has a net loss of revenue of $18.3 million for the 12-13 biennium, and then there are other provisions that add to $105 million, of which the largest is a proposed increase, a proposed statewide property tax on the value of homes that are valued at $1 million or more. The tax would be on the value that is over $1 million. That's a high-level makeup of the $3.3 billion of recommendations, and with that, I would go through the individual pages.
Thank you, sir. Please continue.
Mr. Chair and members, starting on page 6 of the budget pages, this page here, the next two pages, summarize the governor's recommendation for a new fourth-tier income tax bracket to be created with a marginal income tax rate of 10.95%. The bracket would start at $150,000 of taxable income for joint filers, $85,000 for single filers. The adjusted gross income at those levels, based on department data that we have, is approximately $200,000 for a married joint filer that has income of $150,000 of taxable. It's on average, and for a single filer that would be affected by these tax proposals, it's about $100,000 of gross income. At the center of the page, you just see a summary of the current Minnesota tax incidence study that finds that on average the lower 90% of filers pay about 12.3% of their income in state and local taxes combined, and how the share of state and local tax share drops off at the higher income levels at 8.8% of the top 1%. In overall, the recommendation for the new fourth tier would affect 5.5% of all filers, 5% of Minnesota resident income tax filers. About 138,000 filers out of over 2.5 million filers. Going to page 7, summarizes, there's a table there on page 7 that gives adjusted gross income ranges and the estimated tax change, and this is for all affected, an estimate of all affected filers regardless of filing status. Again, you see in the middle column there at the bottom the estimate that of all filers, there would be 5.5% of filers affected. Obviously, filers at higher income ranges, there would be a larger percentage of them affected. Over on the right-hand side, Mr. Chair and members, just to summarize, this is the percent increase in adjusted gross income on average for the filers in these brackets. And this is before any offset from federal taxable income for these filers. So to walk through some of the examples there, in the income range for 200, there would be a number of, there would be filers, pardon me, about in the 100,000 to 199,000 income range of adjusted gross income, about 51,000 filers would be affected, and their average tax change would be about $87, which is about 0.07% of adjusted gross income before any offset on federal taxes. $200,000 to $500,000 range, there would be about 65,000 filers affected, and the average tax change would be about $2,700, about 1% of adjusted gross income. And then you have the category of income range of $500,000 and more. Most filers in that category would be affected by this provision and the next provision, obviously, that I will talk about, the surtax on incomes over that level. And there would be about 2.5%, the average tax change would be about 2.5%. One thing I want to adjust in the language below that we have in the text below that table, the last sentence, there's a reference here to we initially modeled our after federal tax change on an assumption that there would be none of the individuals affected by the federal AMT. There are a number of the individuals that would be affected by the federal AMT, so the 1.7% that you see in this last sentence here would be higher. I don't have a new number for you today, but it would be somewhere between the 1.7 and the 2.48 you see in the table. Mr. Chair and members, I would move on to page 8. Page 8 is the governor's recommendation for a temporary surtax on income over $500,000. This would not be indexed, and this provision would be for 3 years and would expire at that point. It would generate $918 million over the first two fiscal years that it is in effect. The surtax would affect 17,200 returns, about 0.7% of filers, and the average tax would be about $20,300 for those filers. What we have at the bottom of this chart, at the bottom of this budget page, is an attempt, excuse me, members, is an attempt to summarize both the combined impact of the new fourth tier that's being recommended as well as the temporary surtax. The two recommendations combined would only affect the change from the first budget page or the previous budget page we were looking at to this budget page. The only category that would change would be the 500,000 and above. You would see that the average tax increase goes up from the 24,000, I think it was on the previous page, on the previous budget page, to 41,005, and the average percent, that change as a percent of adjusted gross income for the affected tax filers on average would be about 4.15% of state tax. And again, I would just like to make a note that the sentence here above the table that references that would be about 2.7% of effective tax change after federal deductibility, that number will change. And I don't quite have the new number for you yet, but it will be somewhere between 2.7 and 4.15% of effective tax change with federal deductions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, then moving on to, I have a few note pages in between my pages, so page 10 of the budget book. This is another provision that really...
Excuse me, Assistant Commissioner, while you're looking at that there, we would like to introduce students from Spring Lake Park. And I believe, who represents Spring Lake Park? Anybody on the tax committee?
Or that would
someone
be me,
close?
Mr. Chair.
That'd oh, be me. Representative Tilbury. Now, where are the students from Spring Lake Park? Welcome to the tax committee. Thank you. Mr. Mossman, please continue. Mr. Mossman, where did you go to high school?
Mr. Chairman, I went to high school in Caledonia, Minnesota.
Home of the Mighty Warriors.
That's correct.
State champions 3 out of the last 4 years.
Very close to Lane's.
Class 2A. That's Preston.
Preston, my pardon.
Please continue, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is on page 10 is a recommendation the governor is making with regard to part-year residents. Under current law, Minnesota has a bright line test of 183 days for determining residency. The governor believes that there's an important tax fairness issue here, is behind this recommendation to extend the income tax to persons who are here in the state for more than 60 days but fewer than 183 days. But still maintain an abode in Minnesota for at least 6 months. There would be an exception that would be made for individuals who are in the state for the purpose of receiving medical services or family members who are here in support of a family member for those same reasons. Under the change, individuals who are here part of the year travel or live part of the year in other states would receive under this provision, they would be required to pay a pro rata share of their income based on the number of days that they are present in the state, and there would be credits granted for taxes paid to other states if they are spending that time in a state that has that where they're paying income tax as well. There would be a credit for that. Mr. Chair and members, page 11 Sorry, Mr. Chair, members, I have... Oh, here we go, out of order. Again, I'll get used to that. On page 11, the governor recommends to repeal the current law exemption, or the current law credit, pardon me, for Section 125 health insurance plans. Repealing the provision as it is currently provides a tax credit equal to 20% of health insurance premiums paid under Section 125 of the Internal Revenue Code. The Health Care Access Fund under current law reimburses the general fund for these provisions. It's a small dollar amount, and the small dollar amount here really reflects that the participation in this credit has been small. There were 122,000 taxpayers who took advantage of this provision in 2009. The average change per return, or the average benefit, was $362. And really, just in light of, it's actually a fairly complicated form, and in light of all of the other things that are going on in healthcare, the governor recommends repealing this provision in lieu of other approaches related to healthcare delivery. On page 12 is recommendation that evolved out of the department that the governor recommends proposing changes to revise how the how current law how non-resident entertainers are treated under current law. The non-resident entertainer tax would be administered to make it more transparent and efficient, and the intent here is for this to be revenue neutral. Under current law, this non-resident entertainer tax, non-resident entertainers are subject to a withholding of 2% of what is paid to them from the first dollar of their gross compensation. And then promoters withhold the 2%. Resident entertainers are then allowed a $120 credit against the tax that they can take when they file their non-resident entertainer tax return. This proposed change would repeal the $120 credit and require the promoter to withhold 2% only on the amounts above $600. The entertainers would be exempt. Those who receive compensation of less than the individual filing requirements of $93,050 would be exempt. So this, the intent here is to just make some adjustments to the tax code to be to work a little bit better both for the taxpayers and tax administrators.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you.
Members, I don't know if you were all here at the beginning. We're going to let Mr. Mossman go through the whole thing. And please take note of the maybe page number and question. That's what I've been doing here. I've got about 80 questions so far. 79, actually. Please continue, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members, on page 13, the governor recommends repealing the foreign royalties subtraction and FOC provisions in current law. The change here would result in increased general fund revenues of about $272 million in the next biennium. A large part of the discussion here for the governor was not only around the budget circumstances that the state faces, but also recognition that as the state moves closer by 2014 to 100% sales factor apportionment, that many of the originally intended benefits that these provisions were intended to provide in terms of leveling the playing field for Minnesota corporations no longer have the same significance as they do now with 100% apportionment. Also, in looking at the benefits in terms of where these benefits accrue, the department we're finding that about 75% of the tax benefit from these preferences is accruing largely to non-Minnesota corporations. And so there's some question as to whether or not it is the most efficient way to deliver tax preferences for Minnesota-based corporations. Madam Chair and members, on page 15, the governor recommends amending statutes to require that all sales to the state from a unitary business be included in the sales factor for the state. The recommendation here centers largely around as we do move to single factor sales. What we've seen is that some corporations have taken steps or been able to organize 100% of their sales into a single corporation within their unitary family, and then to claim that there is no longer nexus to Minnesota. This provision, this recommendation is directed at the definition of unitary business and nexus around that activity, so that if a corporation is actually has a market here, they're in that they would continue to be subject to the corporate income tax. On page 16, Mr. Chair, the recommendation, the governor recommends repealing the current law allowing insurance companies an exemption from the corporate franchise tax. Repealing the exemption is intended here to put insurance companies on par with other corporations that are subject to the corporate franchise tax. There would be a subtraction that would be allowed for taxes paid on premiums that are sold in Minnesota. And as I know you're familiar, there's also a number of states that have retaliatory, anti-retaliatory provisions, and this would be taken into account in this recommendation so that insurance companies based in states that have retaliatory provisions would be exempt from this taxation in Minnesota in order to address that retaliatory issue. Mr. Chair and members, moving on to page 17, the governor recommends indexing the minimum fee brackets and tax amounts for inflation for the corporate franchise tax minimum fees. Since 1990 forward, the minimum fee was established in 1990, and neither the brackets or the minimum fee have been adjusted since that time. This provision would raise about $16 million. The indexing of the brackets here, and we're still working on getting, at some point we'll be able to bring you some more analysis. You see the bracket changes, members, at the bottom of the page on the left-hand side, the current fee structure, so that right now the minimum fee is based on the sum of a business's property, payroll, and sales, and if that is under $500,000 is the way to read these tables, you would pay no annual fee. If it's between $500,000 and $900,000 and $1 million, you would pay a fee of $100. The fee amounts are not large in terms of, in relative terms. On the right-hand side, you see how the fee structure would change, and the brackets just starting from the $500,000 to $1 million range. For example, at the indexed rate, that bracket would start at $870,000 and would go to $1.74 million, essentially. The annual fee would go from $100 to $170 for that bracket, for the second bracket. For the second to the top bracket, for example, the current businesses, and this does apply to all businesses, but the businesses between $10 million and $20 million currently would have an annual fee of $2 million, and the bracket would go from $17.4 million to $34.75 million of total property, payroll, and sales. And the annual fee would go to $3,470. Some businesses would actually pay a lower minimum fee under this change. Some would pay more, and I don't have all of that information with me today, but as we go forward, we'll be able to get you more information. But different businesses would be affected differently by this provision.
Mr. Mossman, on page 17, the bottom there, you said, for example, 10 million to 19, you said 2 million. The fee is 2,000.
2,000, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You could have settled the budget right there. Right there.
On page 18, Mr. Chairman, the governor recommends amending the statutes to conform to federal law treatment of foreign entities, section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code. Under current law, the distributive share of income for all domestic and foreign partnerships flows to its domestic owners. Under Minnesota law, Minnesota law excludes the net income and apportionment factors of foreign partnerships in calculating net income, and the apportionment factors of the unitary business. The change here would generate $3 million for the biennium. And I can tell you that I know that I have some support staff in the room that this will be a provision when we get to it. This evolved out of the department, something that was intended to be a policy improvement that had some revenue impact in the tax code. Similarly, Mr. Chairman, on page 19 is a provision to exclude REIT dividends from the dividend received deduction. The recommendation here would be to eliminate what we think is an unintended double deduction by excluding dividends received from real estate investment trusts in calculating the deduction allowed to a corporation for the dividends for the DRD from another corporation. The DRD is allowed for dividends received from a REIT. Our finding here is that the DRD allow this DRD reduction allows the dividend received from the REIT to gain a tax benefit that wasn't intended by the original provision. And it's the intent here. And again, I'll have some support staff on this one. I'm sure you'll have questions and want to understand it more. This provision will generate $1 million in revenue in the fiscal 13. Mr. Chair and members, on page 20, the governor recommends modifying the documentation requirements for taxpayers who would be eligible for the current law research and development credit when the base period documentation, when there's base period documentation is otherwise unavailable. What we're finding is that both for taxpayers and for the department, for businesses that would be able to benefit from the R&D credit, but they don't necessarily have a good set of documentation to determine their baseline in terms of what additional research and development activity they have been making from the base period from 1984 to 1988, that it's getting complicated for businesses to establish the documentation and for the department to audit. And in effect, this provision would allow them to forego the documentation and essentially we would assume a base period that would give them the least preferable treatment under the R&D credit, but at least allow them to move forward with participating in the R&D credit. Page 21, Mr. Chairman, the governor recommends adopting statutory language to require that business transactions meet an economic substance test to be allowed in determining Minnesota taxable income in conformance with federal case law. You may be familiar that the state recently lost a case that the Minnesota Supreme Court referred to as HMN, where in effect the department was taking the position that the corporation here, HMN Financial, had essentially arranged its corporate structure for the sole purpose and no economic purpose of avoiding taxation. And the Supreme Court in effect found that because our law was being followed specifically as our law was written and there was no economic substance test that would give the commissioner authority to make an assessment, that the practice could not be prohibited under the law. Minnesota is one of the few, I think maybe one of the only, is my understanding from staff, states that doesn't have an economic substance law, and what is being proposed here would be modeled after some federal case law. There is not anticipated to be much of a revenue impact at this point, but would be beneficial going forward in terms of being able to administer the corporate franchise tax. Mr. Chairman and members, on page 24, the governor proposes to amend state statute for the sales tax nexus to create a rebuttal presumption that a retailer who maintains a place of business in the state, if they have entered into an agreement with a solicitor for the referral of Minnesota customers for a fee, and if the retailer has a gross income of over $10,000 in a 12-month period, that scenario would result in an assumption of nexus to the state of Minnesota for purpose of collection of the sales and use tax.
Mr. Mossman, we went right over pages 22 and 23.
I apologize. Mr. Chairman, can you, it was on page 22 and 23.
It's the federal conformity.
Oh, yes. I'll go back.
Stuff.
Sorry. Federal conformity. I got it. Thanks. The governor recommends conforming to most all of the federal tax law changes, federal conformity provisions on both the individual income tax and the corporate franchise tax that were enacted after March 18th of last year. So essentially the four bills, the two health care bills, all of the provisions of the Small Business Jobs Act, and most of the provisions of the Tax Relief, Unemployment Insurance and Reauthorization Job Creation Act. These provisions overall for the three-year period would have a budget impact of $23.2 million they would have an overall impact of $23.2 million in fiscal 11, $18.3 million in 12 and 13, $41.5 million over the 3 years. I'll highlight, Mr. Chairman, if you look at the bottom of page 22, I know there's quite a number of provisions on the federal conformity menu list, and just to say a few more things about what is included in the governor's recommendation on federal conformity. The governor would propose on section 179, expensing and bonus depreciation, that those federal provisions continue to be treated as they have in recent years been treated under Minnesota law, where there be an 80% add back of the federal benefit of these provisions and a 20% subtraction over the following 5 years. He also does not propose conforming to the additional standard deduction for married filers or the limit on itemized deductions and the phase out for personal expenses and subpart F corporate provision. If you flip to page 23, and again, they're certainly not all listed here. I think there's in total probably around 40-some provisions, conformity provisions. But to highlight what the governor proposes to conform to would be the deduction for tuition and expenses, the deduction for K-12 educator classroom expenses. Both of those are provisions that Minnesota has different treatment for some add-backs under current law. The governor would propose full conformity on those provisions. He also proposes conforming to the working family credit, the increase in the phase-out range for married filers to $5,000 for those provisions, and conforming to the dependent care credit changes, the tax-free IRA deductions, tax-free IRA distributions to charities, as well as the enhanced charitable deduction for food, books, and computers from business inventories. And to note on that one, the computer provision is also one that we currently have in law, an add-back on the Minnesota form. The governor would propose fully conforming to that provision, as well as the deduction for mortgage insurance premiums and the exclusion for employer-provided insurance for children up to age 26. And that would be the conformity recommendation here is with regard to the provisions that I mentioned and the other ones not on this list, the intent would be conformity for all tax years affected. Moving back now, Mr. Chairman, to page 24, the affiliate nexus change item. Going to walk through that again. The governor proposes amending our definition of statute for nexus under the sales tax to create a rebuttal presumption that a retailer maintains a place of business in the state if they enter into an agreement with a solicitor for a referral of Minnesota customers for a fee, and the retailer's gross receipts meet a threshold of $10,000 or more over the 12-month period, that would be presumed to be constituting nexus for sales tax collection in the state of Minnesota. The affiliates here that are being referred to, just to emphasize, would be businesses that are in Minnesota, located in Minnesota, and providing under agreement for a fee a referral of customers to a non-state business, a remote seller, I should say, of products. And if there's that business transaction there between a Minnesota entity for referral of customers, that would constitute nexus. On page 25, Mr. Chairman, this is a streamlined sales tax issue. The Minnesota is currently not in conformance with the streamlined sales tax agreement, something that we would like to continue to hew to as much as we can. The governor recommends that the sales and use tax be amended to repeal the exemption, to ensure that ringtones are exempt from sales tax in Minnesota, that this provision would bring us into compliance with the streamlined sales tax on digital provisions, on taxation of digital downloads. Mr. Chair and members, moving on then to page 27. Pardon me, 26. The governor recommends expanding the definition of direct satellite service to include digital video recording services and programming services that require a subscriber interaction. These services, if a cable user purchases these services, they're currently taxable. But if they're purchased through a direct satellite service provider, they're not taxable. There's no change in the product, if you will, that the customers in Minnesota have available to them that is being taxed. But the means of delivery technology advances, and this means of delivery is not being captured in the definition at this point. On page 27, Mr. Chair and members, the recommendation here is to clarify statutes to confirm what we believe is the original intent of the sales tax on lodging and related services, that this tax be applicable to the full price and charges paid by consumers for occupancy, including any reservation or similar ancillary service costs that are part of the transaction. Historically, Mr. Chair and members, this is really kind of a story of how The marketplace has just evolved over time. Historically, individuals would make reservations for lodging services either through a travel agent or some other means who would be working with a vendor, and then they would get the travel agent would get a fee up front for that service. With much of this being done online, what's happening now is many times consumers are believing, perceiving that they're paying a sales tax or perhaps are paying a sales tax on the entire transaction, and the service fee that that the online vendor or other vendor that the customer is working with is being paid on the back, more on the back end than on the front end, from the hotel providers. And this provision would clarify that the sales tax is applied to the entire transaction. On page 28, Mr. Chair and members, the governor recommends that the sales and use tax be imposed on admissions to suite rentals at stadiums and to admissions at exhibitions and selling events. This change would increase general fund collections by $6.9 million in fiscal 12 and 13. Under current law, admission charges to places of amusement and athletic events, such as admissions to musical concerts, dances, motion picture theaters, presenting stage shows, golf courses, tennis courts, skating rinks, swimming pools, these things are all taxable. But admissions to other events and venues are not taxed. The proposal here would modify the definition to ensure that admissions to home and garden, boat shows, so event shows, promotional shows, and rental box suites and stadiums would be also subject to the event admission sales tax. Mr. Chairman and members, on page 29, another change that evolved really out of the department that the governor recommends, and a story here also with just evolution of the economy and technology and the way services that are already taxable under current law are going to be delivered. Currently and going forward, the governor recommends that the sales tax apply to charges for access and use of remote access, so web-based software that is maintained by the seller of a third party. There's a number of different names that this activity is going by in the industry: software as a service, application service providers, cloud computing. This software purchased at Best Buy or another location, you buy software, or you buy have someone come and provide software, provide those services. Those services are currently taxed under law. Mr. Chair and members, on page 30, the governor recommends a change to the sourcing rules for florist sales. The change is intended to be neutral here. Another change that is hoped to clarify things both for businesses who pay and collect this tax as well as for consumers and for tax administrators. There is a conversation here around the streamlined sales tax. When the streamlined sales tax provisions originally came into place, there was states could essentially choose to continue their treatment of florist sales. As you can imagine, florist sales can both originate in the state or outside of the state into the state. And this provision, the proposed change here, would make the application more consistent for all floral sales by applying the sourcing options. Essentially here would be that the sales tax would be applied based on the origin of the Forest Service. Mr. Chairman and members, on page 31 is a provision that affects only non-residents of Minnesota. The governor recommends that the real and tangible personal property that is located in Minnesota, this is an estate tax provision, that real and tangible personal property that is located in Minnesota but held by a non-resident decedent in a pass-through entity such as a partnership or S corporation, limited liability company, or trust would be part of the Minnesota taxable estate for estate tax purposes. Under current law, the ownership interests in these pass-through entities are treated as intangible assets and assigned to the decedent's domicile at death, and so the estate essentially this amount goes untaxed under the estate tax, but the benefit or the property, the access to the tangible property does pass to the heirs. Mr. Chairman and members, on page 32, another policy provision evolving out of the department that has a modest technical or a modest budget impact only affects the highway user distribution fund and the transit assistance funds. The governor proposes that both the purchase of emergency response vehicles by an ambulance service be exempt from the motor vehicle sales tax, and the lease of this type of vehicle will also be exempt from the sales and use tax. There would be a modest revenue loss. Current law exempts the purchase of ambulances owned by a licensed ambulance service from the sales and motor vehicle tax, as well as the leases for ambulances are exempt from the general use and sales tax. And ambulances also have an exemption from the sales and use tax for their repair and replacement parts and their medical supplies and equipment. But there's, I'll just say, some ambiguity around the overall exemption here in statute, and the intent here is to clarify or make clear, I should say, that the statutes, that these activities are, that these purchases or leases are exempt from the motor vehicle sales tax and the sales tax, or the motor vehicle registration tax. Page 33, Mr. Chair and members, the governor recommends a statewide tax on residential single-unit properties valued over $1 million. The tax would be applied only to the incremental value above $1 million. The provision is anticipated to generate $80.3 million in fiscal 12 and 13, net of some income tax offset for higher deductibility on Minnesota tax returns, and the subsequent the amount in the first year in fiscal 12, the amounts you see in the chart here on the top of page 33 reflect just the timing of when the revenues from this new tax on home value over $1 million would come into the state general fund. Progressivity was a key part of, again, the governor's recommendation in this area in terms of extending some additional tax to high-valued homes. To give a sense of what the impact here would be, in general, the impact is about 1% of the value over $1 million. So if you have a $1.1 million home, the tax would be about $1 million. It would, and if you have a $1.2 million home, the tax would be about, did I say a million, would be about $1,000. The tax would be...
We are going to get this settled quickly here.
Yeah.
The way he raises money.
If the home was valued at $1.5 million, the tax would be estimated to be about $5,000. Just one thing I want to point out on the bottom of page 33. To be clear, there is the potential for some interaction with the existing statewide property tax on seasonal recreational property, as there may be some seasonal recreational property that are residences that would also be subject to this that would have value over $1 million. And the change here would make an adjustment to the seasonal recreational class so that that existing statewide levy only applies to the value up to $1 million, so that there's, and this levy would apply to home value over $1 million, so that there's not, if you're a seasonal rec property that's valued at $1.5 million, that $500,000 would not be, that's over $1 million, would not be subject to both the seasonal rec statewide levy and this new levy. Mr. Chair and members, on page 35 is another provision that the department was a policy provision evolving from the department that the governor recommends adjusting the license fees for tobacco products distributors to $300 every 2 years, so that the fee would be equal for tobacco distributors as it is for cigarette distributors, as well as increasing the license fee for cigarette and tobacco subjobbers to $150 a year. Part of the rationale here is to make the tobacco and cigarette fees the same. Also, there's been increasing concern about just compliance in terms of, as the fees remain very low for the distributor fee, that there's more and more potential for individuals to purchase this fee, pursue unlicensed, unstamped cigarette and tobacco products from out of the state, bring them into the state. So this just makes some modest adjustment in those fees and makes them equal. Mr. Chair and members, on page 36, the governor recommends the repeal of the Minnesota statute that allows a tax credit against the excise tax on cigarette and tobacco products for unpaid debts owed to distributors by retailers, and that is considered an unpaid debt under the Internal Revenue Code. The proposal has a modest budget impact on the general fund of $85,000 and some impact on the health impact fund as well, on the health related to the health impact fee. The issue here is one of a sense that bad debts are a cost of doing business, so bad debts would still be written off in terms of income for federal income taxation, but they would not be a subtraction or a credit for the cigarette and tobacco excise tax. Mr. Chair, members, on page 37, the governor recommends increasing the tax rate for non-admitted insurance purchased directly by an insured from 2% to 3% of the premium paid, to make that rate consistent with the existing 3% rate that's applied under current law when the insurance is purchased through a surplus lines agent. So if the insurance is purchased directly from the provider, it's taxed at 3%. If it's purchased through an agents, it's taxed at 2%. This would make the rates the same. On page 38, the governor recommends conforming to federal provisions for the Non-Admitted and Reinsurance Reform Act of 2010. We believe that these are conforming changes, and they would result in increased revenues of $1.3 million. My understanding of this provision, being educated by my colleagues at the department, is that the federal government has made some changes in this area that in effect will supersede state law, as well under prior to the recent federal law changes, the insurance premiums paid by companies and other not admitted insurance were spread across all states based on risk for the purposes of determining the insurance premium credit that's owed to Minnesota. Under the federal law changes, the federal law changes provide that the tax on gross premiums instead be paid based on where the insured is located, rather than spreading the risk across states. And so this conforms essentially to that federal change. If you are now a business that does has activity and insurance, and you do business all across the United States, but you're not based in Minnesota, you would in fact no longer pay the tax. If you are based in Minnesota, you would pay more tax, but you the net here is anticipated to be a small gain, and essentially what we think we are essentially going to have to do under the superseding language of the federal law change. Mr. Chairman and members, on 39 is a provision, again, that's intended to be revenue neutral. There's a slight change. There is the recommendation here is to repeal, in the hopes of simplifying the tax system, eliminating the bottle tax and making a revenue and neutral adjustment to the excise tax for wine and distilled spirits. This would not affect the excise tax for beer sales. In 1986, Minnesota put a 1 cent, 1 penny per container tax that was intended at that time, as I understand it, to help offset the administration of liquor stamping requirement that we no longer, the stamping requirement, we don't have the stamp anymore. We still have the bottle tax. The intent here would be to repeal essentially the bottle tax from a tax administration standpoint. The 1% adjustment in the excise tax rate is intended to correspond with that. That, Mr. Chairman and members, there are some additional pages, page 41 through 45, 41 through 44 that are included in the budget book here for informational purposes. They evolved less out of the budget balancing conversations around tax revenue increases, relate to other investment provisions in the governor's budget. The governor recommends a 1% increase in the tax for car rentals to be dedicated to the Minnesota Tourism Marketing and Promotion. The 1% increase is estimated to generate $2.6 million more per year to support statewide tourism marketing. These new revenues would be dedicated to those activities. There's a change on page 42, also provided here for informational purposes related to eliminating direct grants for medical education and research costs. And on page 43, for informational purposes, there's a budget change page included here that would also be included in the change pages in the relevant budget areas for these provisions. that would call for the extension of the petroleum cleanup fund and fee. Mr. Chairman, that is a run-through of the budget pages.
Okay, thank you very much for your presentation, Mr. Mossman. Then if it's headlined in darker, darker there, that's leaving things the way they are.
What page are you on, Mr.
Pages 44 through the end.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, pages 44 through the end, again, these are the background pages that you would see. I think you would find that all of the budget areas across the state budget have narrative pages that describe state programs, and this is a description of the tax aid and credit programs, and the governor makes no recommendations for changes or reductions in those programs. So these are here to describe the programs.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Seeing no questions, just kidding. We'll open up for the plan would be we will go till with our regular committee time today, and then we'll come back. We'll have questions of members today, then we'll have questions of members tomorrow, and then at some point in time when we kind of have our questions answered, then we will start taking folks that are supporting the governor's budget proposal and what parts of this proposal they're supporting. And then we'll have testimony from folks that have concerns about the budget proposal. So we will start with questions at this point. Any members have questions of Mr. Mossman, Representative Hortman?
I can't be the first one. I wasn't even here for the beginning. Mr. Mossman, on the part year individual income tax, do you know how common that is? I know when I moved here in 91 from Washington, D.C., I had to pay 5 months of tax in D.C. and then the rest here. And so I just assumed that was a common way of doing it until I became a legislator.
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, I don't know for certain the answer to your question. I think it's probably not common among the states to have a provision like this. I mean, that we do currently tax, as most states do currently tax, if you're moving into Minnesota to become a permanent resident and you're not here for the full year because you just moved here, that you would be subject to tax on your Minnesota income from the time you're here forward for that remainder of the year. This provision is directed at different type of taxpayer and circumstance, I would say, that it's not really that it's not directed so much at individuals who are here part of the year because they either permanently move in or permanently move out of Minnesota, but people who are maintaining a connection to Minnesota, maintaining an abode, a residential a residence in Minnesota, and are in effect tax planning around being out of Minnesota for the 183 days that would constitute Minnesota residency.
Representative Hartman?
Yeah, I understand all that, but I do think this happens quite a bit in other states. And I know North Carolina and District of Columbia, you know, if you're there part of the year, you pay taxes for the proportion of the year that you were there. And so I'm sure there's a chart somewhere that would tell us how many states do this.
Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, I would be happy to try and have that chart pulled together. I don't have something like that with me today.
Representative Portman? Okay. Representative Lesh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mossman, I'm looking at the, temporary, the new bracket, the temporary surcharge, and the property tax provisions. If I'm making, say, 500 grand a year, under this new proposal, am I paying more or less as a rate than I was when I was taxed in the 1990s? prior to the 2000-2001 changes. And I'm assuming, I mean, maybe it's not, but is the answer different if I make 1.6 versus 500 grand a year? And if you need me to clarify the question, I can.
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesch, I understand the question. I'm trying to think if I have the... It would make a difference as to what income level you're at. We have taken a look at effective tax rates. I guess what period of time? Can you clarify what period of time, sorry, are you referring to? What's the comparison point of prior to now?
Let's say 1997. If I made 1.6 in 1997 versus 500 grand, would I under this proposal pay more or less of a tax rate? Effective tax rate.
Yeah. Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chairman and members, I think I would probably I would need to go take a look at that. I don't have that off the top of my head. I think, you know, it would I'm not sure the answer to that question.
Okay.
If I could get the answer, that'd be great. And Mr. Mossman, what I'd really like to see is some kind of graph showing that, because as I stated, I'm sure it's different if I'm making $2 million a year and then I just go downward and approach $500,000, since that's the kick-in. So that would be very handy. Thank you.
Mr. Rossman. Oh, okay. Representative Drazkowski and then Depke. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Mossman. My eyes are attracted to the last pages. You mentioned page 44 through the end are for information only, and there weren't any changes in those particular areas. I'm particularly interested in the last page, page 68, which is a bill that I had before this committee yesterday to end the political contribution refund program. And Mr. Mossman, if I gather this correctly, the governor is planning to continue to have the state subsidize political campaigns. And it appears that we're raising taxes in order to do it. I'd be interested in your comments.
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, the governor recommends no changes in any of the tax aids and credits programs in the budget area. I don't have an answer to your question as to the prior. I mean, I think the overall budget, and certainly these recommendations reflect the governor's overall budget priorities of revenues versus spending reductions and the choices that he made, particular to this program. I don't have a response for you as to the governor's thoughts on this particular program.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Mossman. So, Mr. Mossman, had the governor decided not to continue the political contribution refund, would it be accurate to say that the proposed tax increases would not be as high?
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I don't know that that's the case. Again, it's as you know, quite a large budget challenge of $6.2 billion, and so there are quite a number of moving pieces. Obviously, eliminating or making changes to the political contribution refund program would have a budget impact, and that budget impact could be taken into account in terms of revising the overall palette of the choices, whether or not it would change the governor's tax recommendations versus other recommendations. I don't, you know, that would be a choice that the governor would have to make.
Representative Drazkowski. Representative Depke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, back to Representative Hortman's question on page 10 regarding the part-time residents maintaining a Minnesota abode. Since we are lowering adding the days in there that they are here and taxing that income partially during the year, does this also allow them to vote here if they would like to vote here, since we will be taxing them? Currently, most of these residents choose to vote in the state where they spend the the extra day and they do not pay taxes here, so they give up their right to vote. Are we changing that or thinking about that as well?
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Depke, I appreciate the question. I am not here. I don't have information with me on how the election law would be affected. I don't have an answer.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Biskins. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mossman, I'm looking at page 17, the index of the minimum fees, and you've got the chart below that has the proposed minimum fee versus the current law. Can you tell me on the proposed minimum fee how many businesses rest in each one of those categories? And if you don't have it right now, is that something that you could provide to me later, please?
Mr. Mossman.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't have that. I have asked for some analysis to be done. We're pretty certain that some businesses will pay less, some will pay more. I don't have the count, and most of the dollar amount comes from the higher brackets. But I'll get you that information.
That would be great. I'd be really interested in that.
Okay, thank you. And members, if we could, if you've got a question on a specific page, if you could just give us the page number so we can go to it, or if it's just a general question, that's fine too. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation, Mr. Mossman. My question, it struck me, was also on page 17, but it's really more related to the fourth tier, the new fourth tier bracket and sort of the 3% surcharge. I noted on page 17, in looking at those indexing of minimum fees, it appears that the governor's intent is to be consistent on some of these things in the tax code, but yet in looking at the new bracket and the surcharge would not be indexed for inflation. And I'm just curious as to why that inconsistency. And if staff could confirm for me, I believe that our current brackets are indexed for inflation. Is that correct?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, yes, that is correct. The dollar amounts of all of the brackets, including those in the minimum tax, are now indexed for inflation.
Representative Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Michael. So, Mr. Mossman, why the inconsistency on the indexing for inflation?
Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, the decision, I believe, to not index the $500,000 threshold for the surtax, the governor really sees that provision as a temporary provision, and so the indexing would not apply to that threshold, and after 3 years, the tax goes away under the governor's recommendations. I'm not aware of a conversation related to, you know, linking the two of them up, but the indexing, the minimum fees here is something that has been in law since 1990 and presumably is anticipated to remain in law permanently unless there's some change to that program, whereas the temporary nature of the surtax was, I think, a primary rationale for the indexing choice made there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then, just to follow up, I would understand if something was a temporary surcharge, kind of a what we call a blink off here. But on page six, I'm sorry, I have to put my glasses back. On page six, in discussing the fourth tier bracket, it's my understanding that would be permanent. Am I correct in that assumption?
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, yes, you are correct.
Okay. Well, and it says
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The new bracket would be effective beginning with tax year 2011. It would not be indexed for inflation. So, again, I'm curious as to why not.
Mr. Mossman, why not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, this was a policy choice made that the governor sees. This is all built in as well, I would say, to the numbers going forward in terms of an effort to have structural balance and to have a permanent revenue solution going forward. So there would incrementally over time be some additional value some additional income that would accumulate potentially in this higher threshold without the indexing provision in place. That is my understanding of the provision is at this point.
Representative Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what I heard you say, Mr. Mossman, is basically then for this new bracket, we're just assuming that those people would not be affected by inflation as opposed to other taxpayers. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mossman,
On the 10.95% bracket then, the fourth tier, are we then the top state in the nation, or is there another state that is at that same rate?
Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I believe there are two states that have a higher permanent rate than the 10.95% rate. Oregon, and the other is escaping me at this point. I believe that... Pardon?
Mr. Mossman, I'm okay. Hawaii.
Thank you for the help from the committee.
Representative Runbeck.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Mossman, was there discussion at all as this proposal was being hashed out about the negative impact? I mean, the possibility of, you know, the out-migration of folks, you've got, an estimate here on the impact, but in other states where this has been attempted, people took action. I mean, where was this discussed at all? I mean, they left the state, and it didn't, it just didn't generate those kinds of revenues.
Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, just a couple thoughts. We actually had our research staff take a look at, and you may be referring to the Oregon proposal, I'm not sure, or some circumstances in Oregon I know was one that was looked at.
I'm referring to Maryland's.
Oh, okay. I'm less familiar with that one. I could do some follow-up questions on that one. What we understand from Oregon is essentially that people made less money than they anticipated they were going to make, and so they actually had fewer filers in their top bracket, but they actually had more filers in the bracket below the top bracket. So in the tax year, that was, I think, of concern after they raised their income tax rate. So it's our understanding that there was not the out-migration that is... that was discussed, I know, in some articles, publications.
Mr. Chair, and I'll just reference a comment from the state economist, Tom Stinson, at the November budget forecast meeting when he said that, when responding to a question, what would happen if we did a higher top-tier rate, and he said it would be a drag on the economy. And to me that makes a lot of sense. So I just wanted to voice that. But Mr. Chair, just one other comment. On page 17, the index, the minimum fee on corporations. Do you know where Minnesota sits? Are we one of a few states that do that, or is this fairly typical across states?
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rebecca, I don't know what the status is of other states, and again, I can get that information in terms of having a minimum fee and who it would apply to or brackets or that sort of thing.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mossman, could you send that information to the chair so we can get it to the full committee? Thank you, sir. Mm-hmm. Representative Runbeck?
I'm fine, thank you.
Okay, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mossman, I share the same concerns that Representative Runbeck outlined. In Maryland, it was a 30% drop in tax receipts after they enacted a plan similar to what Governor Dayton is proposing here today. And they lost over $1 billion in their net tax base after doing this. And I'm just wondering, when you were planning out the fiscal numbers here and trying to balance the numbers, did you take into account the flight that we will have out of the state of Minnesota due to this plan?
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the numbers here, the numbers here that are generated by our research department are believed to be reflective of what will happen in the Minnesota economy as a result of the forecast and the tax changes. So this is the baseline that I think that would be used for any revenue for income tax revenue proposals. If there are other proposals that would be considered or introduced going forward, so I think that there is consistency there. I think, you know, to follow up as well on your question and Representative Runbeck's question, you know, the priorities I think that are reflected here with the rate are the governor's priorities around the tax incidence in Minnesota and his interest in having a more progressive overall state and local tax system. And this is the income tax being the only progressive tax in the portfolio of major taxes. In order to achieve that, the governor, I think, just felt strongly that this was the revenue source that would need to be changed in order to balance the budget and improve the progressivity of the tax.
Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Mossman, can you tell us then what was the decline in revenue that the analysis revealed and how much that was?
Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't get that level of detail from the research staff, and the model doesn't run that way. There wouldn't be a generation of an estimated decline or in terms of the context that you're asking the question. It would be based on a baseline of tax history, tax filing history, and the projections for economic growth in Minnesota, and the model, in effect, as I understand it, would generate assumptions about a tax rate change.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mossman, looking on page 10 at the part-time resident portion, just a question or a couple quick questions just for clarification. Specifically, if you're looking at the snowbird provision, if you have folks that live in a state where maybe Social Security income isn't taxed or their veterans' retirement pay isn't taxed, and they are here in Minnesota for longer than 60 days within this window of time, would they then be taxed on that? Is that considered a Minnesota-sourced income? Could you just shed a little light and clarification on how that would work?
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to phone a friend on this one, if I could, and ask Mark Peterson to come down from the department.
Which friend are you phoning?
Mark Peterson.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Representative Mack. The way that this proposal is that Minnesota for non-residents, these would be non-domiciliaries that we're trying to get at here, non-residents, we would tax 100% of the income that they have from Minnesota sources, and then we would tax a portion of their non-Minnesota sourced income. So in response to your question, I think the answer is that if they have the taxable pension, the taxable Social Security, taxable interest, dividends, things like that, Minnesota would tax a portion of that income based on the number of days that they were in the state over the number of days that they were maintaining an abode in Minnesota.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up, could you shed some light on how that's enforced, how exactly it's tracked, how many days, and how it's proved how many days they were in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack. Well, that is something that taxpayers would have to keep records on. And I know that right now it's relevant in the context of 183 days, and our experience is that the taxpayers who are getting close to that are aware of the law, and they are keeping reasonably good records, and we end up having some disputes generally over a few days as we get close to the 183. But they keep records, a lot of records on charge accounts and things like that that they're able to reconstruct. A lot of them keep diaries and detailed records.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mack, if I could just kind of underscore part of what Mark said, taxpayers already would be keeping track of this information in terms of the time they're in the state, because we already have the 183 day test for residency. So we think that most of the taxpayers who would be affected, who would be doing tax planning around this provision, already keep track of the number of days they're in Minnesota.
Representative Mack?
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That's helpful. One other point of clarification: do those days have to be consecutive, or, you know, for instance, I know I had a constituent who had a child that lived out of state. They were very sick. They were here multiple times throughout the year. You know, probably upwards of 3 months. If it's not consecutive, but they're here visiting back and forth for family crisis, something of that nature, that would also fall under this. Whether it's for sickness, I mean, I guess maybe there is something in here that talks about medical services, but I'm imagining that's only for the exact patient. If it's a family relation, does that also apply?
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack. Yeah. The days do not have to be consecutive, that's for sure. There is an exception in here for if there's care for a family member, so it wouldn't have to be the patient. It could be a spouse or a child or a parent. Those days would not count.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I met last Friday evening, had supper with one of the owners of the New York Yankees, and I asked when he came in, I asked him how his flight from New York was. He says, well, he flew in from Florida. And I said, oh, Florida. I said, well, where are you resident of? And he said, well, I live in New York and Florida, but I'm a resident of Florida for obvious reasons, no state income tax. When he was audited by the IRS and the New York Department of Revenue, whatever they call it in New York, one of the key questions was, do you have a dog? And he said, yes. He said, and the question was, where does the dog live? Do we have a dog rule in Minnesota? I mean, that's just serious. It was interesting. The dog, thank heavens, was in Florida, but then it died, so now he doesn't have a dog anymore. He was very sad. Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chair, I don't think we do. I know we're looking at amending the rule. Maybe that's one of the things we should do. But one of the things that the rule does, I mean, residency does look at, is where are your prized possessions? Where are the things that are, you know, the family heirlooms and things like that? So that's how that could have become relevant.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Mossman, I'm wondering, page 22 and kind of into the area of federal conformity. I know Minnesota hasn't always conformed 100% with some of the federal tax policies, but I had a question on the additional standard deduction for married filers. And is this kind of what's been referred to as the marriage penalty that it was addressed kind of at the federal level? And secondly, if Minnesota is not conforming, I'm wondering if that's a change from current policy, and how many other states do not conform?
Mr. Mossman?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, I've always referred to it as the additional standard deduction for married filers. I know that there are probably other references that people may make to it. The provision, conforming to the provision, I do not think has been, and we conform right now. We don't really, well, effectively, we conform. We do conform right now. The additional provision, the choice really made here, conforming to this provision would essentially be about $110 million ticket item, and the choice really here for the governor was just one of many of the difficult choices that I think he and everyone will have to make with regard to the budget. I think it certainly was not an interest in wanting to conform. It was a budget-related issue as to how it would fit into the budget. I would just add that, you know, the taxpayers who would be affected by this provision obviously would continue to benefit from the federal change, which is where individuals would get most of the tax benefit related to this provision would be the federal benefit. They would not get the additional state benefit from conforming to this provision, which would be a two-year provision.
Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Massman. So then this change would affect taxpayers who are married in virtually all income tax brackets in the state. Is that correct?
Mr. Massman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, yes.
Okay. And
Representative Loon.
Thank you. So do you have an estimate of how many married joint filers in the state of Minnesota would be paying additional taxes as a result?
Mr. Massman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, I do not have an estimate of the number of taxpayers we're talking about. I can certainly get you that. I would just add that no taxpayers would pay additional tax in Minnesota relative. We would not be extending the benefit for the 2 years by conforming to this provision.
Representative Loon.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And yeah, if additional information is put forward, I'd be interested in any calculations on how many taxpayers would be affected in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Massman. I think that one of the things on the other federal nonconformity issues on page 22 is, again, an effect with the increased Section 179 expensing and bonus depreciation, that area, the business area. And can you give me the dollar value and what amount that might be?
Mr. Massman.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, the dollar value, and can you just give me the provision and the year again? What is it that year? What dollar value are you looking at?
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is on page 22 where it says the Section 179.
The first bullet point from the bottom there?
Yes. It's on your budget book on page 22.
Mr. Chair and members, unfortunately, Mr. Chair, only have in front of me I don't have the dollar value for all of the years. There are, Representative Kiffmeyer, as you're, I think, alluding to, different ways that Minnesota could approach this. Minnesota does not currently conform fully to this Section 179 for expensing or the other provisions related to bonus depreciation. We have not. I think the circumstance here is very similar to the rationale for having not conformed in recent years, which is a budget one, and that the recommendation here is to continue what is already the current law treatment for those federal conformity provision for those federal conformity issues, which would be to require an 80% add back and the 20% subtraction over 5 years. So it really, I think, from the governor's perspective, was a budget issue as well as a recognition that taxpayers already are familiar with Minnesota's approach to this provision and continuing forward that provision.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Massman, I will look forward for those numbers. I think the effect of that, I think one of the things we've had discussions with before is when you pay more in your corporate taxes, it's regressive, meaning that it is always passed on to the consumers and all of them. So when, you know, one way or the other, this will be borne by others, not just in particular any business that deals with this. So, but if you could get me the amount and the numbers and some of the fiscal impact of either partial or full, I would appreciate that information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I know we're running out of time, so these are probably questions that are going to have to be made or answered in the next hearing, which I want to applaud you, Mr. Chairman. You've been very fair in giving the governor's budget, his tax provisions, some due consideration. I believe it's been in front of us as a legislature for about 25 and a half hours, and I think House File 130 was in front of the governor for less than three. So you know, I think we're giving the respect to the governor that he deserves, and I hope he does the same to the legislature. I'm a little concerned. Representative Loon asked a question about how many states currently do not conform to the marriage penalty, and we didn't get that answer. Representative Runbeck and Representative Anderson talked about did we learn from other states when it comes to raising taxes on the highest bracket, and the answer was, well, we're not sure. You know, the beauty of our system is supposed to be that it's a republic and 50 learning labs, and we learn from each other, and yet it seems like the governor is looking at Minnesota as an island, and an island he will be creating with this budget. Unfortunately, it'll be a deserted island. I hope that the next time that the governor's staff comes before us, they will tell us what is their analysis of this budget proposal, what does it do to the top marginal, to the marginal tax rate on the top income earners when you combine this budget proposal with the president's budget proposal, and tell us what that number is. I hope that there's an analysis from that this budget includes in its numbers an analysis and consideration of what is happening to our surrounding states, and what will happen with business in Minnesota as surrounding states look at a very different way to solve their budget problems. I don't know if this is a static or a dynamic analysis. Are we looking at everyone remaining in place and saying, thank you, sir, may I have another? All right. And I think those are questions that are appropriate to be asked of the legislature, and issues that are appropriate for us to think about as we look at solving this crisis of having $2 billion more dollars in revenue than we had last biennium, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Bisgins. Representative Debke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to ask one quick question that's regarding page 33, the state residential property tax, and it estimating adding a surtax on property valued at $1.1 million and over. Could you tell me who is the responsible entity for determining that value?
Mr. Mossman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Debke, the intent here is that this statewide tax would be a levy amount approached in a very similar way to the current state levy, that there would be an amount that would be set in statute at the state level with a rate determined, certified by the department based on the statutory language, and then that rate, which we estimate at this point would be about 1%, would be determined at the state level on an annual basis, and then we would inform the local governments who would then apply that rate on the property tax and collect and remit the money to the state.
Representative Debke?
Yes. Well, I would hope, and we can get into this further. We don't have time to vet it out here, that it would take into consideration current sales in the area. I know that there's tremendous amount of concern, and there's a one-year lag from the time a piece of property is valued, and then by the time it's valued again, and very often that $1 million level is a critical level for selling a home, and very often a resident cannot really justify the way their property is valued at the local level based on sales and what the public will be able to absorb as far as costs. So I think we have time to vet that out, and I want to look into that further. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Debke. I have on my list yet Representative Lynn Chesky and Runbeck, but the hour of 12 o'clock having arrived, We will pick up, we will adjourn the meeting now, but we will pick up tomorrow with questions. So members, read through the material and ask questions. We'll have Mr. Mossman back. I'm sure he's looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Good government all the time. We are adjourned.
You know, I got 10 minutes.